moving along, you know, we have this new medication that's actually been already been approved for exon 20 insertion with dual antibody treatment. It actually binds to the EGFR and also binds to the MET. And so from my understanding, when you have this EGFR resistance, you create like overexpression of MET or MET. And so the idea is to kind of dual antibody both, and they're both on the same cancer cell. So it's not like an antibody targeted where you kind of like a bite, you kind of bring them together. It's already on one cell. And so we got this New England Journal of Medicine article. We got the amivantamab plus lorazepam, which is apparently very similar to osimertinib, but might not be available here in America. And so this was a phase 3 international randomized study where 2-to-2-to-1 ratio patients with EGFR exon 19 or L858R randomized in 3 arms, amivantamab, lazertinib, osimertinib, and lazertinib. And then the primary endpoint was PFS. And then so far in this paper, the median PFS was significantly longer in the first-line setting for amivantamab and lazertinib group than in the osimertinib arm. What are your thoughts about this MARIPOSA study, Stephen?
So I think you summarized the study really well. MARIPOSA is, I think, an important study, and it's another advance, and it's another combination option that is better than osimertinib alone. I think there are a lot of parallels between this and the FLAURA2 study. It is a different approach, though. There is no chemotherapy involved. The drug amivantamab, to be honest with you, Chandler, and I don't know if we exactly know how the benefit is conveyed. There are a lot of possible reasons why this drug could be really important here. You know, like you mentioned, this is an antibody. Antibodies typically have these two arms, and for the most case, they'll both bind the same thing. But here it's been modified, engineered in a way that on one side you're binding to EGFR, on the other side you're binding to MET. Now, when we think of the EGFR, you're not specifically binding to the mutant EGFR. And so when we think of EGFR mutant lung cancer, the deletion 19, the L858R, we know that the TKIs, drugs like osimertinib and lazertinib, are very good at blocking that signal, very effective in cancers with those mutations. Blocking EGFR, you know, using the antibody properties of amivantamab to block EGFR adds another dimension. And these combinations of antibodies and tyrosine kinase inhibitors have been affected now going back for quite some time. So this may be a way to double down on blocking that EGFR signal. And when we think of why osimertinib stops working, there's lots of different reasons, but amplification and increase in that EGFR signal is one of them. And this could prevent that from happening. At the same time, as you mentioned, it's also blocking MET. MET, we know amplification mediates resistance to osimertinib at least 15-20% of the time. We know combinations of MET-targeted agents plus osimertinib have been very effective. Using MET-directed strategies in the first-line setting could be more effective as well if we see baseline overexpression of MET. So MET and EGFR, I think, are both very important. And amivantamab can sort of tie all those together. Amivantamab is interesting, though. It also probably has some immune-type properties as well, not a traditional checkpoint inhibitor immunotherapy, but through a process called trogocytosis. It can trigger sort of immune-mediated cell death, and maybe that's important, too. So there are a lot of possibilities. This combination, as you outlined, increases the progression-free survival. There was a trend towards an improved survival. But just like FLAURA2, that is not yet statistically significant. I personally believe it will be significant over time, but I need to see that to really be sure. And it's just not mature enough. We just don't know yet. Here, again, is that improvement in progression-free survival justify the increased toxicity? Anytime we're adding more drugs, it's more side effects. Lazertinib itself, I would think of as really just a one-to-one swap with osimertinib. It's a third-gen TKI. It's approved in South Korea. It's a drug developed by the South Koreans. It is a drug that has shown in randomized trials to be better than frontline TKIs in basically the LASER 301 study, which is, I think, the equivalent of the FLAURA trial. So just as effective, third line agent, great CNS tolerability. There is a little less diarrhea, actually, with lazertinib.
Oh, wow.
But I think overall, pretty similar as far as I can tell. So lazertinib is sort of a one-to-one, I think, exchange with osimertinib. And now you're adding amivantamab. And so you're adding more toxicity there. You're adding more skin toxicity, especially rash, especially on the scalp, which can be challenging. More paronychia than the fingernails. The infusion reactions, while I know there are concern, I think of them as more of a nuisance and not necessarily something that is going to impair long-term quality of life. But you're getting infusions. Here you're getting infusions really every 2 weeks instead of every 3 weeks. So is that trade-in worth it for an improvement in progression for survival? I think that if it translates to an improvement in survival, then I think that there's a much stronger case to be made. But in the absence of a survival benefit, I think we need a little bit more information as to the true value of either of these combinations up front.
Yeah, you know, that rash is very interesting. From what I readings, it's very similar to like a cetuximab kind of rash. Maybe it has to do with that EGFR targeted mechanism mm-hmm. of action. And you know, the other thing that kind of really caught my eye, Stephen, is the increased risk of DVTs and PEs, the venous thromboembolism. That's something that really jumped out at me. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the rash, I think, is a lot like a cetuximab rash. Really, the troublesome part for me really is that sort of on the scalp. And there are some ongoing studies now. I mean, to the sponsor's credit, they are doing large studies that are looking to upfront mitigate these toxicities to try to prevent them. I think that's a really important strategy. The venothromboembolic events are a real toxicity. So VTEs, DVTs, blood clots, we know we can see that in anyone with a history of lung cancer. They were seen in that combination of amivantamab and lazertinib. Not lazertinib alone, not amivantamab alone, not amivantamab with chemo, but when we give amivantamab and lazertinib together, for some reason, we do see these higher rates of blood clots. Now, with osimertinib alone, you can still see VTEs. There, it's about 10%. But you increase that to, you know, 35%, 37, 40%, somewhere around there, with a combination of amivantamab and lazertinib. And so if someone's starting on a regimen with amivantamab and lazertinib, venothrombolic prophylactic anticoagulation is important. And we typically recommend that for a period of about 4 months. But that is a real toxicity.
Yeah, something we have to kind of keep an eye on. Like you mentioned, maybe one out of three patients. And, you know, something that, you know, if they have any leg swelling or chest pain, you got to really jump on it. And like you mentioned, prophylactic anticoagulation. I think that's the key, you know? And the other thing that might be coming down the pipe is the sub-Q version of this medication. So maybe with some of the infusion reactions, like you said, you're pretty much parked in the infusion center, like in the first 3 to 4 weeks, pretty every week and then every 2 weeks in the first 2 days on treatment. So maybe the sub-Q, what was your thoughts on that data on the sub-Q?
Yeah, fascinating data here. I think this is going to really change things. That might tip the scale more towards this regimen. When we think of the subcutaneous, there are a couple important differences. One, the infusion reactions pretty much go away. It's not to zero. You still saw some infusion reactions with the subcutaneous, but when you look at the types of effects that were coming with those infusion reactions, it was a much milder, different type of infusion reaction. So we're not seeing those major infusion reactions that's going to cut down on chair time. People will be able to go in and out. In terms of toxicity as well, we saw lower rates of blood clots. Hard to know exactly why. What I think took the cake for me when Dr. Natasha Leal presented these data at ASCO, this is the Paloma 3 trial. This was comparing subcutaneous to intravenous. We saw lower infusion reactions. We saw lower VTEs. Patient satisfaction scores were better. Times were shorter. And also, survival was better.
Wow.
Now, that was a little difficult to explain. And this might have something to do with the immune basis for activity here. And I think this needs to be confirmed in other studies. But I got to tell you, once the subcutaneous is available, I don't see any reason why I would still give the IV. Subcutaneous wins across the board. And when we think of the time toxicity, the time spent in the hospital, it goes down so much more with subcutaneous. We'll see, I think, some patient-related outcomes and some patient-specific data presented at WCLC this year from Dr. Miriam Alexander. And I think those will be important data. But in terms of patient-first strategies, the future world, I think when we're seeing subcutaneous amivantamab, eventually we're going to see subcutaneous checkpoint inhibitors. I think the future patient-friendly approach to cancer care is going to be not to bring the patients in for these shorter visits, but to send the drugs out to the patient. Is there a world where you and I can partner with a nurse who's going to go to that patient's home or to their work or someplace they don't even need to come in, deliver their subcutaneous treatment, maybe as part of their maintenance? We do a telehealth, just like we're talking now, and really just try to be even less intrusive to that patient's life. I think that would be sort of the ultimate goal. There are a lot of steps that need to happen before we get there, but I do think that's the future.
I love that. I mean, that's a patient first. You know, that's not reminding them have to come to the cancer center. They get the infusion or the injection sub-Q, and we kind of watch and do televisits. I think it's phenomenal. I hope that this is where things are moving, because that's a great model for our patients.
Yeah, I think it will.
So, you know, last question, Stephen, and I really enjoy like talking to you about this is, you know, we have a lot of general medical oncologists that, you know, now we have three prospective first line metastatic, treatment options. You know, we got the osimertinib, right? And then we got the FLAURA2 with the osimertinib with chemo. And then now we got this antibody treatment with avatamab with the lazertinib. What are your thoughts or any guidance here? Because like you said, there's many different ways you can go. And from my understanding, if they progress on one treatment, you come back with the other one with the antibody treatment, or if you start with the antibody treatment. So what are your thoughts? Any advice on that, Stephen?
No, I think the first thing I'd say is there's not a clear right or wrong approach out of all three of those regimens. Once these three regimens are FDA approved and reimbursed, I think all of them are actually reasonable strategies. And we don't have a biomarker, a test, a specific type of patient where one approach is clearly better than the other. If we look specifically at the FLAURA2 and the MARIPOSA data, patients with brain metastases did seem to do better with the combinations. But I think we've had patients with brain metastases do very well with osimertinib and have done well, you know, really for the past 6 years. So I don't think it's going to be wrong to choose any of these specific regimens. And when there's not a clear right or wrong answer, it really is a discussion with the patient and a shared decision-making model. I think there are pros and cons to each approach. The best option, I think, always is a clinical trial. And sort of the next generation of drugs is going to help us refine that further, get access to better agents. But we just to be very transparent about the pros and cons of each approach. With osimertinib, it is safety, lifestyle, convenience, ease. I think those are all favoring osimertinib alone. With chemotherapy, this is a familiar regimen, platinum pemetrexed. It increases the progression-free survival. We've seen that improvement there. But we don't know if it increases overall survival. And there's, I think, a detriment in quality of life, how time is spent. With amivantamab, there's different toxicities that we see, and you still have that infusional schedule. To me, the big differentiator, I think, is yet to be determined. And I think what we're going to be watching for closely over the next few years, one, is there a difference in survival? Because even if I can explain it away and say, oh, there wasn't crossover, I can make up for it with second-line treatment, survival is a hard endpoint. And if patients in one arm lived longer than the others, I think patients deserve to know that. So if there's an overall survival benefit, I think that that really speaks. Now, if both of those combinations have an OS regimen, now we're still kind of stuck, and I don't think it differentiates, but one is OS positive and one is negative, I think that's going to be tough to explain away. So one is OS. Two, when we look at progression, our focus is on when progression occurs. It's only part of the story, though, and I think how progression occurs is also very important. We look at how progression occurs, specifically, are we seeing different patterns of progression? On one regimen, are we going to see sort of progression in various places, or are we going to see more progression in the brain? Are we seeing more leptomeningeal progression? Because that's something I really like to avoid. So if, for example, we give MARIPOSA and the progression-free survival is the same as FLAURA2, but we don't see any leptomeningeal progression, well, I think that's a real advantage then. And so the patterns, or vice versa. So I think the patterns of progression and sites of progression is important. What drugs we have to give second line and how they're going to be affected based on that initial regimen is all part of optimal sequencing. And if I give, for example, patritumab deruxtecan, an ADC, if that gets approved, I give that second line. Is that going to work better if that person got osimertinib alone first line, or osimertinib chemo, or osimertinib or amivantamab and lazertinib? And so, you know, how would that frontline regimen key up resistance so that my second line regimens will work? Now, it's true that we expect amivantamab to be approved in the second line setting with chemotherapy. That's the MARIPOSA 2 regimen. And right now, that's even today, even before approval, that's listed in the NCCN guidelines and has really been my regimen of choice after osimertinib. If we use that up front, then I can't use that second line. And so I think that those are some considerations important. But to me, the biggest thing is going to be, is there longer survival with one approach over the others?
Yeah, I love that. I mean, Stephen, you kind of mentioned it, like, you know, we're like scientists, and we are like in terms of clonal selection and natural selection. So whatever treatment you receive, you might create a different clone. So you have to do the study and see if the second line might be different based upon the first line treatment.
That's right.
You know, I love that. You know, and the other thing is we're kind of fine tuning and we're always constantly learning. And a good example of that is, you know, whenever we give patients, like when we first had metastatic with immune therapy, a first line, everybody got chemoimmunotherapy. But then we're finding that if the patient had an EGFR mutation and they you switch them from one immunotherapy to EGFR, you might have more toxicities like the lung. And so I think one of the things that I've learned from just talking to the general oncologist is just do the chemo first. Get that liquid biopsy, get that solid. And if you have an EGFR, they're not primed with immunotherapy and they might have worsening toxicity. So we're kind of fine tuning. Any thoughts on that, Stephen?
Absolutely important. We want to try to avoid these targeted agents, not just for EGFR, but for ALK, ROS, you know, RET. We're going to try to avoid giving those drugs in someone who's had immunotherapy. So ideally, we have that information before we start. I think the perfect answer would be to get that information quickly through liquid biopsy, through rapid NGS, and have that information before we start any treatment. But as you know, there are some people that need to start treatment right away. If they do, we start chemo because we can walk back from it. When we start immunotherapy, you kind of change the toxicity profile of everything afterwards. And for some people, that effect will be permanent. That's the whole appeal of immunotherapy, right? It's this permanence, it's this durable effect. We think of it for good things, but it's true for bad things too. So it's best not to paint ourselves in the corner, to wait for those results before starting immunotherapy. If you've got to start, we start chemo because that wears off. If we start immunotherapy, that effect may not wear off. And so now everything afterwards may be a little bit more toxic. But I think the key would really be to get that driver mutation testing done very quickly, have that information. I mean, it's always a treat when you've got that full panel ready for you before you even see the patient. So if we can improve our reflex testing, get rapid blood tests with all biopsies, if it's part of the initial diagnosis, I think it's going to make everyone's life a lot better.
Oh, thank you so much, Stephen. You know, here on our Unplugged on OncLive, really appreciate your time. Love your guidance on this. And thank you so much.